This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omised, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omised.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor super fan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Congressman Nick Langworthy, he's my congressman in NY23. Congressman, good morning.
It's great to be back with you, Joe.
Hey, Congressman, lots going on. Let's start right here in the good old state of New York. The corrections officer strikes, obviously, many of them went back to work, but for the ones that didn't, the state is banning them from state jobs. What are your thoughts on the way this has been handled?
I think it's been handled disgracefully by Governor Kathy Hochul. I mean, she has abused corrections officers to the point where they had to walk off the job, not for more money, not for more fringe benefits, but for their own safety. And the fact that she is now, for those 2,000 or so that have just held out, the fact that she's now trying to break them and ruin their lives beyond firing them is absolutely nothing short of disgraceful. No other union in the state of New York that they do business with would be treated the way the corrections officers have. And, you know, I heard those stories when I was out on the picket line in the first few days of this strike at Collins. And, you know, you heard continually the HALT Act, you know, allowing the prisoners to have contraband, you know, brought in by family members, mail that wasn't being screened, body scanners that weren't being used, no ability to have any punishments for bad behavior in the jail. Really, the prisoners were running the jail. And the fact that she is now vindictively coming at those people that ultimately said they just could not go back and were terminated, and trying, and then we see our county executive parroting that effort and trying to extend that to Erie County so that they can no longer ever receive a government job, even if they're qualified to do that. It is just disgraceful, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
What are your thoughts on the National Guard filling those positions, you know, a job they didn't sign up for?
Somebody's going to get hurt or killed. And, you know, these are dangerous places. National Guard members are great volunteers in an augmentation of our national defense. And, you know, some of them have been deployed into, you know, places of foreign conflict. But they're not trained to run a jail. They're not put through the academy of that our corrections officers are, which is a very intensive program where they learn all of the tactics to run a jail or a prison. And now these people are being thrust into that. I mean, the stories coming out of it are terrible, and it should not go on. But, you know, here we have a shortage of corrections officers, to no surprise. I mean, they were down 1,200 bodies when the struck took place. And you know, has this been an advertisement for why someone should go into the field of being a corrections officer? It was once seen as a very good job for people, particularly in our rural communities in the south towns and throughout the southern tier, to have, where you could provide a good living, good benefits, a good career. And now people see how the position's been treated, and who's going to line up to take the test at this point?
That was my next question. It just seems for a position that's already having people an issue with people signing up, not only do you, this is the way I look at it, not only do you have, you know, these issues now advertised, they're not going to permanently get rid of the HALT Act. And, I mean, it looks like the union can only do so much to support the workers.
Well, the union, you know, unfortunately has, under the New York State Taylor Law, doesn't have the ability to really fight the way other unions can, because the Taylor Law gives the state all the leverage in the negotiation. But at the same time, you know, there's going to be a real shortage of people, just like we've seen in law enforcement, following cashless bail, less is more, clean slate, all of the different anti-law enforcement, pro-criminal policies of New York State. There's less and less people taking the route of going to the academy, taking the civil service examinations to take a career in law enforcement. And many of our cops, if they're of a certain experience level, maybe they have their years for New York, they're going to other states where they're getting bonuses to come and join law enforcement in areas that are growing. We have a crisis of personnel in law enforcement and corrections, and this is of the state's making. This is something that they could have handled. You know, in this deal, we have a 90-day suspension of the HALT Act, but if they just come and wake up and just at the 91st day reinstitute all the problems of HALT, we're going to be right back to it. And even with the suspension of HALT, we see the news out of Attica where several of our corrections officers have fallen ill because of exposure to some kind of chemical or fentanyl. This is a growing problem. It has not gone away because of the strike. Kathy Hochul and all the politicians in Albany need to wake up and join the choruses of people like Rob Ort and Pat Gallivan and George Borrello, who have been pushing so hard for real reform in this area. They need to suspend and eliminate and repeal the HALT Act. You know, I'm sure there's some elements of that bill that can stay, but largely you have got to give our corrections officers tools to keep law and order inside the prison walls.
All right, Congressman, let's head to D.C. and DOGE. Always, it seems like every morning DOGE is in the headlines. What are your thoughts on the way DOGE is handling its job and the way the judges are pushing back?
Well, it's moving quick, obviously, is we are bringing accounting and accountability to the federal government for the first time in generations. We're evaluating the fact, do we need a 2.4 million person workforce? And the answer is no. And I'm not surprised that you're seeing legal challenges across the board of, you know, people balking and trying to preserve the status quo. But President Trump wasn't elected to preserve the status quo. He was elected to be the change agent to get the country back on track. And the 2.4 million person bureaucracy is a lot of the reason that we are where we are. You know, I can speak firsthand because my office every week tries to solve problems for constituents. And, you know, we certainly have liaisons in departments that are very helpful, but there are some agencies, particularly the Department of Education, where it's a joke. Even with a congressional inquiry, they're not going to get back to you for 6 months or a year about somebody's critical problem that they have, whether it be with a federal student loan or some other problem. And the bureaucracy has not been responsive to the people. And a lot of that is the fact that there's no accountability in the departments. They, you know, these agencies in some instances hadn't been back into an office setting for 5 years following the onset of COVID. That's changed. And, you know, obviously we've heard a lot of loud noise out of people very upset that they actually have to go to an office and go to work like the rest of the, you know, civilized world. And, you know, that is a change that has been made. We are asking people, what did you do? What is your job? What are your obligations on a weekly basis? Because this is the most bloated organization in the world. I mean, we have too many employees for the roles and the output that they do. And what we've uncovered through the DOGE process is expenditures that even Congress didn't know we were spending money on. And it's certainly not a valid expenditure of U.S. taxpayers. I mean, the USAID got a lot of attention. I actually voted against an amendment by one of the members of the Freedom Caucus to our National Defense Authorization Bill that would have cut USAID's budget in half. And here I look at an agency that I felt was tasked with, you know, providing food and medicine and humanitarian aid to those war-torn areas or people that were in deep need. And what did we find out through the DOGE process? That we're spending money on social engineering around the globe based on the ideology and the extreme ideology to the left of the Biden administration. You know, we had transgender surgeries. We had all sorts of, non-binary gender education going on in foreign countries like Burma and Sri Lanka. And there's no one asked for this. No taxpayer said, yeah, this is a need that the U.S. taxpayer needs to fill around the globe to preserve peace and to help people at their greatest time of need. I mean, $20 million for the U.S. federal government to create a Sesame Street for the people of Iraq. I mean, this is just a total waste and a boondoggle. And we're going to continue to uncover those sorts of wasteful spending pots that are going on across our government. What I've challenged my constituents when we've had conversations about this, and I always hear this term, it's only, and then fill in the blank number, whether it's 20 million, a billion. People lose track of the value of a dollar when you're talking about government expenditure. But, you know, as we're getting here up on tax day, I want you to look at your return and look at what the amount of money that you paid into the federal government was. And then I want you to think about whatever that only number is. Say it's $20 million for the Sesame Street. How many of your neighbors or how many people across the town that you live in or the county that you live in have to be added up in what they paid into the federal government out of their payroll deductions to reach that number? And then ask yourself, was that worth the entire federal tax obligation of our community? I think not.
Great way to look at it. That's like my wife and I right now looking at our taxes. New York State held back 400. Hey, you could say it's only 400, Congressman, but we're going to try hard to get it back.
As you should. And, that's leading to a lot of what we're working on to try to, extend the current tax code that President Trump brought us in 2017. It created unprecedented growth before COVID. And honestly, it was so good to the Biden administration that they didn't make any efforts, even when they controlled the entire government, to take it down and reinstitute the old, because it creates jobs. It creates a competitive environment in the global marketplace. And then we're going to try to supplement that with things that are really pro-worker, like no tax on overtime, which I visited a factory this week to talk about. You know, we need to be the most productive industrial output that the world knows. And one way to do that is to and partially one of the ways that we could solve some of the labor shortages that we have is to incentivize harder work. And that is no tax on overtime. A lot of people skip overtime because they see, I can work another hour, but the tax man's going to take a lot more of that. If we can eliminate tax on overtime, you take that barrier away and people will want to work more. They will want to put more time in. They'll be able to afford that extra vacation or help, pay their bills in this, time where we've got this tough inflationary hangover of the federal government spending way too much money. And I do believe help's on the way and things are ticking in the right direction, but it's going to take some time. But this will put more money in workers' pockets compare in added up with no tax on tips and no tax on our Social Security income. I think will be a huge boost to our economy.
That was my next question. Tax on tips, tax on overtime, when that might hit the floor.
Well, this is all going to be part of our budget reconciliation. So you're going to hear a lot about that. And what budget reconciliation is it's Washington speak for when a new president comes in and the Congress is all of one party. We are able to do what Trump is calling, and he's the branding expert, one big, beautiful bill. And I typically like single topic bills, but this is an opportunity for us to neuter the Senate to some extent and not have the pesky filibuster be in the way. so we can extend the tax code of 2017 and hopefully make it permanent. We can keep those rates where they are. You know, and those rates are critical. You hear a lot of people in the Democratic Party that want to say that this is tax cuts for billionaires and the rich. What this really does, you know, we had the doubling of the standard deduction, it put a lot more money in people's pockets. That's part of this. Doubling the child tax credit. That's part of this. If we do nothing, those go away. And you have a higher rate of tax across the board. Every family, working class, middle class, obviously the job creators as well. Everyone, it's a $4 trillion tax increase on the American people if we don't extend this. And the clock's ticking, 1231, that tax code expires, and we revert back to those Obama-era tax numbers, which are obviously much less competitive. They take money out of people's pockets and actually make us less competitive with our countries around the globe. And, you know, this tax code brought so much money that was parked offshore by big companies and brought it back here to the States and put it on the street and put it to work. And that's why businesses created jobs like never before after that 2017 tax code was accepted and passed into law. And we have no choice but to move forward with that. I mean, I'll say it again. The Democrats had all the power in the world to repeal that tax code. They didn't do it because they knew it made America more competitive, more agile, and made business thrive. So we have to get the job done. That's part of it. No tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, and no tax on overtime are new key components that President Trump wants to put in there. One, to have our seniors, you know, have more money in their pocket. They already paid tax on the Social Security income for years and years and years. I mean, it is important that they have access to that money in their golden years and can, you know, pay their bills, increase their standard of living, and not worry about filing another tax return and have the federal government take another slice of what they get now. No tax on overtime, as I said, will make us far more competitive in the marketplace, increasing productivity, but also putting money in workers' pockets. In making them enjoy the fruits of their hard work and labor, it'll help businesses thrive and be able to not struggle because this is a tough marketplace for labor. We need more people to enter the labor workforce. And, you know, if you got a good employee that wants to work overtime, they should have more incentive to do that. And the economy will grow and we'll have more productivity because of it. And no tax on tips, I think, is you know, when you give money to someone that's provided you exemplary service, you're not expecting Uncle Sam to take a big piece of that. That should be something. It will help, you know, the overall hospitality experience because you'll have more people that are more talented go into that field of service working. They'll be able to see the direct benefit of great service. Because they'll pay less taxes on it. And again, you'll have more sales, more people out enjoying the dining experience, because what's the big barrier when people feel like, you know, they're not getting good service, they're not getting the experience that they used to. People are going out and spending money less in ways like that.
Congressman, a few weeks ago we had Congresswoman Claudia Tenney on, and she was talking about the tariffs, the president's tariffs on Canada, and I think I got the phrase right. I think she said she was cautiously optimistic about the plan. What are your thoughts on the Canadian tariffs and the way the president is handling it?
Well, obviously the president's always negotiating. And I think we're hypersensitive to this here in the Buffalo area because of our proximity to Canada. I don't believe the rest of the country is on eggshells about tariffs with Canada. But given our binational, you know, location, it is a little more front of mind here. I don't want to see us have a prolonged fight with Canada. They're our neighbor. They're our friend. They're our ally. And they... sell an awful lot more products to the United States than we sell to them. I've certainly talked to some manufacturers this week that have, you know, some concerns because they make a product here and maybe have it finished in Canada and they don't have clarity as to what that's going to mean to them. There's people that purchase the aluminum that they use in manufacturing here from Canada, and it's making it harder to compete for contracts. My hope is that, you know, tariffs work here because it's going to bring everyone to the table. The USMCA, while at the time was a good deal, it's not a good deal for the United States right now. And Canada is far more protectionist for our products going into Canada than we are to their products coming in here. I mean, talk to people in the dairy field. It's almost impossible to sell their products into Canada because of high tariffs. They levy far more tariffs on our products than we do on theirs. I see some headlines this morning that some of these countries, particularly Canada, they're going to be coming in and we're going to have a negotiation before that April 2nd deadline. My hope is that, you know, this, you know, tough talk on both sides is going to lead to a better deal where, and I hope a bilateral deal. I don't want to see a deal that includes Canada and Mexico all in one deal. These should be individual relationships with individual countries. I mean, first and foremost, the tariff threat brought Canada to wake up to the border, and they have now devoted some resources to border security. I believe they're devoted to it. I met with a consul general. I think that you also see fentanyl. They're waking up a little bit to the fact that they are part of the problem. They're not the Mexico-sized part of the problem, but they're part of the problem of drugs coming into the United States. Their lax immigration laws concern me greatly because they're letting everybody in legally to their country. And a lot of those people, their destination is the United States of America. That concerns me because, you know, a lot of our national security threats, as I've talked to ICE and U.S. Border Patrol, more than half of our real true national security threats have come across the northern border, not the southern border. And, you know, northern border security is something that I'm very devoted to. So I believe that, you know, having a strong disagreement like this brings parties to the table. We can iron out a deal that will make everyone win. And to have free trade, you've got to have fair trade. And the barriers that Canadian companies or the Canadian government puts on our companies trying to sell products in, that can't be fair trade. And we need a better deal. I think we can get to it. I hope everyone has clean hands at the table. The problem is the Canadian government's also going through a parliamentary election right now that's razor tight. Trudeau is gone, and his kind of leftist regime, I think the people that have followed him are a little more centrist. They should be able to do business and find some common ground. But, you know, their political silly season is upon us. So that's also bleeding into this a little bit.
Congressman Nick Langworthy, as always, thank you. And I've got to thank you and your office for getting my grandmother a beautiful letter for her 100th birthday. Thank you so much for making that happen.
Well, happy birthday, Grandma. Happy to help anytime. No problem is too big. No problem is too small. We love to help our constituents.
Well, thank you so much, Congressman. Talk soon.
All right. Take care.